Thank you very much, Robert. John MacArthur is our next presenter for this afternoon. He's the Chief Executive Officer of the Millennium Promise Alliance, and he's also the former Deputy Director and Manager of the UN Millennium Project in the U.S. So, John MacArthur, come on up.
Thank you very much. I was invited over the summer to come here and jumped at the opportunity as a Canadian from British Columbia originally, take any chance I can get to come back. And now that I know I'm from the province with the best life expectancy in the world, I'm a little more motivated to keep running. So it's great. So thank you. Originally, I was asked to talk about extreme poverty, and I'll share some thoughts on that. But I just got back from Kenya. I was in the northeast of Kenya a few days ago on the weekend, and I am struck right now with what's happening around the world, and I think this is an important juncture for us to talk a bit about that. Reading the newspaper this morning on my way up from New York is quite fascinating. The front page of the Financial Times is about President Obama calling for China to depreciate its currency. The leading economics commentator in the world, Martin Wolf, wrote his column today saying he wished President Obama would have given the Chinese government a lecture on economic policy during his one-on-one with the leadership of China. He was suggesting he should have given a lecture. On the same front page, Chief Executive of Goldman Sachs issued an apology yesterday for Goldman Sachs participating in, quite complicated financial structures over the past few years, alongside a pretty innovative announcement of partnership with Warren Buffett to support small businesses across the United States. This is, at the same time, we had a global food summit and global hunger crisis summit over the past 2 days, which basically reiterated for the nth time, it's hard to count, the fact that there's a global hunger crisis happening. This is very weird, and it's very confused, and we have also seen, of course, the public recognition in the past few days of what we all knew was coming, which is there's not going to be an agreement at Copenhagen on climate change. We're going to hopefully see an agreement on principles for the following year. We saw that the legislation that is pivotal for the global discussion in the U.S. Senate has been postponed until 2010. Everyone's just kind of waiting to see what happens next in a lot of the institutions around the world. But moment to moment, what's happening is quite critical and very much a crisis in many parts of the world. I was in northeast Kenya in the Somali region where the conference room was a lot different than this and made of wood sticks. And we were sitting together talking about the fact that they just got rain for the first time for a few days. And this is the same place that was subject to a devastating drought. It's part of the drylands region, which is a hotbed of instability across the Sahel and right through on the same band over to Afghanistan. We're making major decisions over whether to send troops, whether to send more troops as a global community into that hotbed. And we're not solving these problems in a systematic way. And so in the absence of solving those problems, I focus on issues of extreme poverty in my own professional work. And I think it's interesting to talk, in a conference like this that's focused on different forms of social policy, different forms of inequality, what basic systems of leadership and accountability might look like as a core premise. I think this is actually a fairly defining moment right now for the next few generations on what those systems might look like. I actually don't think we know as a world, and I think we're struggling in different walks of life to figure that out. And I can tell you the governments aren't in the lead on a lot of this. Business, as much as it's been the source of a lot of economic implosion in the past 24 months, is actually also providing a lot of leadership in many areas. And a lot of business leaders are personally providing a lot of critical global leadership where a lot of government leaders aren't. And we're seeing a lot of non-governmental organizations provide critical leadership where no one else is too. And so the notion of what should the world look like, how can we build systems that solve our problems in a sustained basis, is, I would say, an open topic and perhaps the foremost, because our institutions are in many ways on the brink right now, much more profoundly than a lot of us see. So I'll talk a little bit as a frame about the poorest parts of the world. The very poorest parts of the world are technically defined as those living on less than a dollar a day. In 2000, there was the largest ever gathering of world leaders in September 2000 at the Millennium Summit, where world leaders came together and agreed in a pretty path-breaking declaration, among other things, that they would spare no effort to free their fellow men, women, and children from the abject and dehumanizing conditions of extreme poverty, to which more than a billion were at the time subjected. Importantly, they didn't just say nice words, they set concrete targets with a timetable through to 2015. In 2000, setting goals for the world to make progress against extreme poverty by 2015, 15 years out, was a pretty remarkable breakthrough for a global community. The targets were very practical, dealing with hunger, income poverty, child mortality, primary education, maternal mortality, access to safe drinking water, and basically the goals set to cut by half each of those basic challenges. The challenges of health, education, infrastructure, economic livelihood, slum dwellers, very basic practical targets, but with a deadline. Now, how has the world actually been doing on those targets? This is a graph that shows the number of people living in extreme poverty up to 2005. This is the best official data we have of comparability around the world. It shows that you've gone from about 2 billion people, a little less in 1981, down to about 1.8 in 1990, about 1.6 in 2000, and now close to 1.4, a little bit lower. Meanwhile, we've had massive expansion of the global population. We're approaching 7 billion people. We were less than 5 in 1980. So the percentage of people living in extreme poverty has actually come down dramatically. Importantly, the composition has changed dramatically as well. So whereas in 1981, roughly 1 in 10 of the people living in less than a dollar a day were in sub-Saharan Africa, and today it's 1 in 3, by 2015 we're on track to be 1 in 2. So extreme poverty around the world is becoming increasingly an African issue. Now, one of the things we can't show in this graph is that if you were to take the curve through to 2007, 2008, you'd have a big uptick of at least 100 million people, based on the latest estimates. So the global financial crisis actually pushed another 100 million people below a dollar a day. It's important to keep in mind that an economic situation caused by the most concentrated sources of wealth and power in the world had the greatest impact on the people most marginalized and without any capacity to cope in the world. Now, if you look at where those people are, this is a map my colleagues and I made at the UN a few years ago looking at extreme poverty, not measured by dollars, because that's really just a proxy, but by infant mortality and underweight. And if it's dark orange in this map, shows infant mortality rate more than 80 out of 1,000 live births. That means more than 80 out of every 1,000 don't make it to their first birthday, and more than 20% underweight. If it's dark orange, it's both variables are bad. If it's light orange, it's one of those variables. And you see, again, extreme poverty isn't exclusively an African issue. Certainly key challenges in Asia. And you see SNPs in Bolivia and Mongolia and so forth. But it's a pretty dramatic picture. Now, if you just look at a simple graph or a simple map, that my colleagues made on the ecological factors that are conducive to the transmission of malaria, you see that that's not a very different map. Why do I show this? Well, first, because we're talking a bit about health issues here, but also because it's very important to understand these are factors independent of human influence. So the transmission of malaria, especially falciparum malaria, the killer form of malaria, which has all sorts of variables that go into it, ranging from the type of mosquito that carries the parasite to the temperature, year-round temperature, which affects the reproductive rate of the parasite in the belly of the mosquito. All these things go into this map, which shows that if it's dark-colored, which it is especially in West Africa, you have extremely high propensity to malaria. That kills on the order of 1 to 2 million people a year, most of them children, mostly in Africa, most under 5. It's a huge challenge of extreme poverty around the world. This is a clinic that I was in earlier this year in northern Nigeria. This is the pharmacy of the clinic. This is where they keep their aspiring medicine. These boxes are all basically empty. That's very much the norm in rural sub-Saharan Africa. The majority of Africa lives in rural areas. It's the one part of the world that's still overwhelmingly rural, even though the transition is happening. It's overwhelmingly rural for some basic issues of low food productivity, but this is what it looks like to go to the hospital. This is what it looks like if you go to a malaria ward. This is in Malawi. These are children in malaria coma. Most of them, they're all under 5. That's what it actually looks like. If you think in practical terms behind the numbers, this is mass death. I didn't know about this growing up in Vancouver. Didn't come up. We don't talk about it. Because it's poor people who are dying of this, and it's another part of the world, and we think, oh, malaria, we had that in Mississippi. They got rid of that. We don't talk seriously about it. There's a couple other key issues. I mentioned the hunger summit. This is a quick graph of food production per capita around the world since 1960. Basically, look at a few lines. The blue one on top is East Asia. That's a takeoff, 250% increase in food production. Sub-Saharan Africa is the only place that actually had a decrease in food production per capita over the past couple of decades. There are many reasons why that's taken place, that flatlining of food productivity, one of which is the structural adjustment that pulled out support for smallholder farmers. Another piece of it is technological. The seeds that could have been high yield weren't available till the 80s. Another one, though, is that there's so little water, and Africa actually has rain-fed agriculture, whereas most of Asia is irrigated agriculture. If you're in the Sahel, that band below the Sahara, you're also in part of the world that's had one of the worst drop-offs of precipitation since 1970. This is a graph of average precipitation over the past century in the Sahel. These are countries like Mali, Chad, Niger, Somalia, Ethiopia, and they've actually, in many ways, lost the rains over two generations. Many of the same places, by the way, that we read about in the paper for their instability. That's a little bit depressing. But it's real. On the other side, the breakthroughs are really possible. And I want to spend just a few minutes talking about the breakthroughs that are possible, because I think it's really important for understanding what's needed, because none of these are fait accomplis. These are just the problems we need to solve. So global public health has actually had a tremendous, tremendous takeoff in the past 10 years. This is general global financing for public health. Sorry, it's a little bit faint. But for a couple of decades, you had about $3 billion a year of global public finance for health. In the early part of this decade, that actually took off, and there's been more than a trebling, and if you were to go up to this year, it would be about $12 billion. It's a huge breakthrough. But it's not just money. What is it that led to that breakthrough? The biggest single factor that led to the first change of the arrow was the Global AIDS campaign. The Global AIDS campaign led to a transition from in the early part of this decade, around 2001, there was about 10,000 people in Africa on antiretroviral treatment, while more than 1 million a year were dying. Now we have more than almost 3 million people on AIDS treatment. And in June 2001, it was considered by many people in the global health system technically impossible to deliver antiretrovirals to people in low-income settings. They were too poor. They would never be able to adhere to a drug regimen. They'd develop resistance. None of it's going to work. This was official policy. But actually, it became quite practical, and we're in the middle of half the people who need it now have access to treatment. It's a huge breakthrough. We've also had a tremendous breakthrough in the past 4 years, in malaria control. In the spring of 2005, I was in Washington literally getting lectures on why it was a bad idea to distribute bed nets because they'd use them as wedding dresses, they'll use them for fishing, they won't appreciate them, they'll just sell them, you know, a lot of reasons. Well, thankfully, actually, President Bush launched the Presidential Malaria Initiative in 2005. This kickstarted a huge program and really a private sector mobilization, too. A couple of key private leaders, Ray Chambers, who was a legend of Wall Street, has since become the Secretary General Special Envoy for Malaria, and then Peter Chernin, the head of News Corp, literally made bed nets a household issue in the United States. American Idol had a special episode, Idol Gives Back, and bed nets were in there. Amazing. That was 2 years ago. Well, today, at latest count, the target is to have 330 million bed nets distributed by the end of 2010. That's to reach every endemic sleeping site by the end of next year. So far, in the past 3.5 years, 200 million bed nets have been distributed. It's an extraordinary breakthrough. In Malawi, which was the perfect storm, the former head of UNICEF, Carol Bellamy, described it as the perfect storm. No food production, ravaged by AIDS, always ravaged by drought, rampant malaria, next to Mozambique, which had 15-year civil war, couldn't access anything economically in the global community. That country, in the past 3 years, 4 years now, has doubled food production as a country. How did they do it? They made sure every household had a voucher to get fertilizer and seeds. And the president, Mutharika, did so against prevailing wisdom, where he said, you guys are allowed to subsidize your farmers? Fine, me too. And he did it. And the country actually became a net food donor during the global food crisis last year. Literally called the head of the World Food Program and said, we'll help. An amazing breakthrough. In my own work, we've done a lot of effort to do something, what we've called Millennium Villages, to support communities around Africa to actually achieve the Millennium Development Goals, to say if we actually take these commitments seriously, what would it look like for agriculture, health, education, infrastructure, water? And importantly, most of this has been backed by private sector leaders, private philanthropists. George Soros is our single biggest supporter. A lot of major companies saying, sure, I want to achieve these goals. Tell me what to do. Or I've got a technology. Here's how I can help. And this, for example, is what it looks like to have high-yield variety seed of corn, well-fertilized compared to poorly fertilized, low-yielding seed of corn. This is economic growth for a farmer. That's what economic growth looks like when you grow food for a living and you don't grow enough to feed your family. health systems, the before and after is extraordinary. General Electric actually has made a huge contribution to making maternal health units available. Drinking water, the simplest thing in the world. It's only a small portion of the global water crisis, but drinking water, a very straightforward, practical thing. Education, you can't describe what goes for a school in a low-income setting. The simplest possible refurbishment, backed by a school meals program that the community can introduce once it grows a bit more food, to donate some at the household level to the schools. These are all very practical things. Now, the challenge is that we don't put any money into these things as a global community. We all hear about money down a rat hole, where's the money going to go, how do we know it's going to work? The reality, just on an empirical basis, this is dollars per African per year that all donors around the world have been putting in since 1960. And what you see is it's been about $30 to $50 per African per year. That's all the Cold War stuff, that's all the humanitarian aid, that's the emergencies. And right now it's about $40 per African per year. That's how much money we're throwing at the problem, so-called. Everything I just said, the health, the agriculture, the infrastructure, the water, we pay for at $60 per year per person. You can't do it for free, but with $60 you can do quite a lot. Now, since we are in Canada, I think it's important to remind ourselves how Canada's doing on this. The reality is it's doing extremely poorly. Now, Canada's, of course, the home of the Global 0.7 target. It was former Prime Minister Pearson who established this in 1969. It was then, through the Pearson Commission, it was then accepted by the General Assembly in 1970. Prime Minister Martin, when he was finance minister, supported this target in 2002, as did Prime Minister Chrétien. Foreign aid actually was much higher under Brian Mulroney than it has been under recent governments. This is actually not a partisan issue. This is a societal issue. And there's been an uptick, but still very far behind. And Canada actually ranks as a share of its income 16th out of the 22 countries in the Club of Rich Countries. Gives about 0.3% of its national income, although it's promised 0.7. I just want to conclude. What are the key elements of success that we've learned? Because we've seen these great breakthroughs, but we've seen these great challenges. Well, having looked at a bunch of these, you see that the basic success stories include key performance targets, known technologies, whether that's antiretrovirals, whether it's bed nets, whether it's fertilizer, what have you, adequate finance with follow-through on the finance, global mechanisms like the Global Fund to Fight AIDS to be Malaria for achieving scale, auditable accounting systems so you can check afterward, did the money go where it's meant, and then critically clear leadership. And the leadership very often comes from the places you don't expect it. I've listed a few here. Bill Gates, we all know, George Soros, Ray Chambers, Peter Chernin, Rajat Gupta, used to be the worldwide head of McKinsey and Company, Dan Vasella, the head of Novartis, made sure malaria treatment was available around the world. Karl-Henrik Svanberg, the head of Ericsson, has done amazing things for making cell phones available to the poorest people in the world. Indra Nooyi, the head of Pepsi, Sumitomo Chemical, which makes the bed nets. Extraordinary leadership from all walks of life. So Canada is hosting the G8 summit and G20 summit this coming year. It's a lot of questions. What's going to happen? Well, I think this is the basic accountability summit of our time. This is not just a question of what Ottawa is going to do. It's a question of what Canadians are going to do. The government matters, but the businesses matter, the non-governmental organizations matter, the universities matter, the think tanks matter. This is about all forms of leadership. 2010 is the final check-in en route to 2015. This is the last chance to make a serious commitment for the Millennium Development Goals to tackle extreme poverty. Canada, as a country, has an extraordinary responsibility in the next 8 months. Extraordinary. And it's a choice. It's a choice for the government, it's a choice for the business leadership, it's a choice for the university leadership, and frankly, it's a choice for everyone in this room. What are we going to do? Let's do something good, let's do it together, and let's make sure that we are the last generation to know extreme poverty. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sean.